Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's hear it for our super producer and our own legal beagle, Mr. Max Williams.
He's so litigious. He's always just suing Willie and or Nilly, left and or right.
No, that's just you, Noel.
You're Noel. I'm Ben.
And it's true.
And that's and you guys are going to behave yourselves because we're all friends here.
I never sued no one. Not never, not no how. I don't even know where to start.
I read recently, just over this past week, a story about a guy who was a judge who sued a family dry cleaner for $54 million because, according to him, they lost a pair of his pants. And this guy was so litigious that he actually lost his job. My favorite line, I almost texted it to you guys, was they had to pause. This is a quote from the article. They had to pause court proceedings because the guy apparently got so emotional when he was questioning himself about losing his pants that he broke down in tears.
Were the pants on him at the time that they were dry cleaned?
No.
Were they magical pants? I'm confused. Were these lucky pantaloons? What? $50 million? That's absurd. 54. Surely he did not win.
No.
I mean, were they white?
Unclear. I think they were just regular khakis. But the thing is, that guy did lose his job as a judge, which he should have, because he weaponized all his legal knowledge to just torture this family so much that it's just like a mom, dad, and a kid. And he tortured them so much with appeals and yada, 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 that they almost moved back to South Korea. So we know that you can be a bad faith actor in the world of courts. And we're going to talk today about something. This might end up being a two-parter, something that I think has fascinated all of us. And it's something we started running into a lot in the world of podcasting. I don't run into this in my day-to-day life.
You know, honestly, it was in through podcasting and colleagues of ours and, you know, various deals and things like that, that I started hearing the term IP thrown around. And for the longest time, I didn't really know what it meant and never really bothered to ask. But it's a real umbrella term, you know, and it refers to a whole lot of stuff. Innovation, software, engineering, entertainment. It's a real catch-all term that basically refers to the way you can protect and or commodify and or sue on behalf of an idea and the way people, you know, treat ideas.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It is such an umbrella term. Intellectual property. I had the idea. this idea is mine. But this applies to so many other things. The manufacturing process for pharmaceutical substances, the algorithms used to assess your credit score, even words like Google or the brand or brand logos like the Golden Arches at McDonald's. I'll never forget my first brush, my first serious brush with IP, getting into legal trouble for it. I got a pretty strident letter when I was working on that animated show for kids called Stuff of Genius about inventors. And you guys have heard this story. The people who own Frisbee, the trademark Frisbee, they are hardcore about it. If it's not a Frisbee brand Frisbee, it can only be called a flying disc. I'm out here trying to like tell eight-year-olds about how Frisbees came to be. And I got a cease and desist or a C&D in the business.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And it will, you know, we'll probably get into this a little bit, but it's also sometimes a brand or a trademarked, you know, concept can become so ubiquitous that it becomes a catch-all term in and of itself. Like Xerox has become, you know, sort of like, I mean, it's not even so that people do that much anymore because who holds paper, but you know, there was a time where you'd say Xerox me this, you know, document or whatever, and that would just refer to making a photographic copy, a photocopy, I guess is the term. But yeah. Xerox is obviously the biggest brand, you know, in that world. Or, you know, in certain parts of the country, a soda pop is a Coke. We live in that part of the country. Or, yeah, Frisbee, exactly. Or Band-Aid.
Google, you know? Kleenex. These are proprietary eponyms. And
that's
once,
the term.
Yeah, once that stuff comes out, the problem is no matter how many people you take to court, you can't stop billions of people from just collectively deciding to say we Google something when we internet search.
You know, I encountered something that is pretty hilarious, and I don't know if this is actually protectable IP or if this was actually registered as a trademark, but are you guys familiar with the movie Birdemic, Shock and Terror?
I am not.
It is a really, really, really low budget, hilarious. It's like in the zone of The Room, the Tommy Wiseau filmic atrocity that has become kind of a cult sensation. It's in that kind of vein of just, you know, so bad it's kind of amazing in and of itself that it even exists. It's got like, it's, you know, it's a love story, it seems like, but then it also these like killer birds enter the scene. And if you watch the trailer, the birds are just clearly like badly Photoshop kind of After Effects on, and they're like hovering while their wings are flapping and they're just kind of hovering in place. But in the trailer language, they refer to it as, or the directors refer to it as, the master of, quote, the romantic thriller, which is followed by a trademark symbol. I don't know if that's sufficiently creative enough to warrant a trademark. We're going to get into what some of the criteria are for getting a trademark, or, you know, yeah. Ideas have to have a certain amount of originality. They have to just have a certain amount of novelness, et cetera. And then there are other laws that can protect these, you know, rights of the intellectual property stakeholders. But then there are also laws that keep it from getting a little too, you know, protected.
Right. And those laws are going to surprise you along the way. At some point, I'm going to figure out the etymology of legal beagle. But for now, yeah, let's be aspirational. But for now, I think, maybe one of the things our fellow ridiculous historians need to know from the jump is that the concept of intellectual property, or IP, is super duper old, way older than you might assume, all the way back to 500 BCE in a Greek colony named Sybaris. There were these chefs who were granted legal monopolies for a year at a time over the creation of certain dishes. So they would say, look, you're the only guy who can make the fig farfignugan here, which was, you know, as we all know, huge in Sybaris at the time.
It's not a cookie, it's fruited cake. Everyone knows that. There's a really cool book that collects a lot of this history, and it's called The Genesis of American Patent and Copyright Law by Bruce Bugbee, which is a great name. He highlights a couple of interesting cases, one involving Vitruvius, who is said to have essentially codified the idea of intellectual property theft during a literary contest that he oversaw in Alexandria, where he was one of the judges. Vitruvius essentially called out, you know, put on blast some other poets that he referred to as being false, because he believed they had stolen the words and turns of phrase of other writers, of other poets.
Which would be super easy at the time because, you know, the only way to transmit things would be word of mouth or writing it down and physically transporting it. So these people could be stealing stuff and the audience would never know unless someone brought it to their attention. The other times, because in this book that you mentioned, Bugby talks about three different cases of IP law in antiquity. The second and third are also from Roman times. And even though there's not a specific Roman law we can point to about IP, we do know that Roman legal experts discussed this in depth. You know, like, okay, if there is a painting on a table, who owns the painting versus who owns the table where the painting is on? There's also the idea, like you said, literary piracy or plagiarism, and people have been caught out reciting the works of other folks. Then there are examples that might be a little more unusual. Because there was this huge network of power structures, monarchies, in ancient times granting privileges, like the royal patent. We make the king's shoes, you know, and then franchises, different favors. Bugby has a cool distinguishment between these. He says, look, the difference between systems of intellectual property versus franchises or royal favors is that the franchises, the royal cosigns, restrict access to intellectual works, ideas that are already in the public sphere, and so they take something away from people. An inventor, on the other hand, is just adding something new to the world. They're not taking away anything that was already there, and that's why you get to, like, authors would copy each other all the freaking time. You know what I mean? And AI is kind of just an iteration of that. AI is the crack cocaine to the powder cocaine of early plagiarism.
Yeah, indeed. And it's interesting because, I mean, one person's influence is another person's theft, you know? And we know that artists have borrowed from other artists throughout history. Writers have borrowed ideas and sometimes, you know, whole concepts or even specific turns of phrase from other writers. And it is a little bit of a gray area. And some of these intellectual property laws are designed to kind of make that a little clearer, make those distinctions a little clearer. But it doesn't always work, you know, because it is, we do live in a world of intersecting influences. So it's really kind of hard to sometimes say, you know, and we see it a lot too in like lawsuits surrounding maybe music. You know, I believe it was Ed Sheeran just won a couple of lawsuits where he was sued for supposedly, you know, lifting a melody from like a famous R&B song.
Once we talked about that. Yeah, Dan Fogerty wasn't Fogerty in Creedence Clearwater? He got sued for music that he had made because it sounded too much like himself.
Too much like himself.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah, it was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody. Like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
right?
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it so. The Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Point being, you know, once this, when stuff like this, when creativity starts to get too litigious, it really cracks down on creativity and it makes people scared to, like, you know, try things. And so it's a fine line, you know, where you don't want people to be open to outright theft and someone could, like, profit or benefit from literally stealing someone else's idea. But also there's only so many notes in the scale. There's only so many, you know, story
letters,
archetypes. 100%. So it is, you know, it's kind of a delicate dance, but I think this is a very interesting place to start with these examples from antiquity. Another example comes from the birth of the Florentine Republic, where, you know, rulers were basically passing out franchises and a lot of, like you said, Ben, there were these arbiters of kind of royal favors and privileges. And Ben, this really reminds me a little bit, at least, of our snake oil episode and the idea of these royals essentially having carte blanche to say, no, this is fine. And this person's able to do it. And they have, you know, exclusive rights to make this medicine that we have deemed to be efficacious through our God-given ability to, you know, do science, which isn't the case at all.
It turns out that, just like we talked about in our previous Vatican City episode, that anytime you are in a society where just one person can decide whether something is good or bad, you run into ridiculous situations. Let's go back to this idea of patent, very much related to intellectual property. A patent sort of locks down the concept that this is your idea, and whatever happens with it later, through the work of others, you should get a piece of that if it's based on your concepts. And this takes us to the Republic of Florence. It's June 19th, 1421. There's a guy named Filippo Brunelleschi. He's a famous architect, and he gets this one of the first statutes that protects the rights of a creator. And the Republic of Florence says, okay, you write something, you invent something, we respect that it's your idea, and we're going to give you incentives for this. And those incentives might vary case to case, but what they were also saying, one of the incentives was, if you sign up, if you apply and you get a patent, we're going to crack down on people who are trying to take your stuff. And that's very appealing to people at this time. And this becomes a huge piece of patent law as it exists today. The idea that you will be compensated legally if someone infringes upon your idea. And then the other concept was a term limit on these inventors' rights. So that's why you hear about things going out of copyright in the world of literature. And for quite some time, the mouse, we all know who I'm talking about. The mouse had some of the best copyright and IP lawyers on the planet, stretching laws every time Mickey Mouse almost got into public domain.
Well, and I think they finally run up against the ceiling of all of those efforts.
They did, yeah.
I think that's right. And I'd heard that they were considering pivoting from Mickey being their primary, you know, mascot to this little dragon called Figment,
yes,
which is pretty prominent at Disney World now, the Figment. And I think he's been around for a while, but there is like a statue of Walt Disney like holding Figment. And he's certainly been in the canon for a bit. And there is a Figment ride with, I think it's John Cleese or no, Eric Idle, I think, from Monty Python is one of the narrators or figures in that ride. But it doesn't seem like they fully pivoted to that. But I did read that a ways back, and I'm interested to see how that goes. But yeah, I mean, like, through their, you know, just absolute army of lawyers, of intellectual property lawyers. I mean, you got to think about it. Disney, you know, I was telling you guys off air that me and the fam watched the 1951 Alice in Wonderland last night. And it holds up, man. It looks absolutely modern. It's so cool, so innovative. And of course, they're going to protect that stuff. And like Disney was just basically one of the first to market with this kind of concept of like scaled, high-level, glossy animation. And they innovated with things like the multi-plane camera. So of course, they're going to be protected for that. But up to a point, you know, there does come a point at which it's like it is kind of counterproductive to the public interest, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes the public can get lost in these conversations. Let's go to the English system. So over in England, they see what is happening in Italy, and they like a lot of the Italian ideas. So the English system creates something called the Statute of Monopolies in 1624 and the confusingly named Statute of Anne in 1710.
Right.
The Statute of Monopolies says if you invent something, if you write something, you get the monopoly over that for 14 years, which was a long time because, you know, people died pretty frequently.
Yeah, exactly.
So this means we're not going to grant any exclusive rights to non-original ideas or to works that are already in the public domain. So you can't be the person who goes into court and says, I want a patent on the Book of Job.
Or
I
tacos.
That's my thing. Mm-hmm. If you introduced them to tacos, you would have blown their minds. That's a good point.
Bad example. But the point is you can't just say something that's already been out there, that's been styled on many times by different parties. You can't just say dibs, you know, like because I said it first. Mm-hmm. That's not how that works. You have to demonstrate, whether through drawings or, you know, some sort of documentation, that you, in fact, are the innovator of a certain idea. And I think you made a good point earlier, Ben, that this was like an incentive for creators. This type of law is what spurred a lot of innovation.
Mm-hmm.
If there weren't protections, then it would not really benefit creators to come out with this idea, because people more powerful than them could just snatch it right out from under them. Not to say that didn't still happen. Certainly did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is an excellent point you're making. We also, let's look at the Statute of Anne, because a lot of scholars in the field consider this to be the first modern copyright statute. And it's, we can see where they're coming from with it. It goes in part like this. Whereas printers, booksellers, and other persons have been lately frequently taken the liberty of printing, reprinting, and publishing books without the consent of all the authors and proprietors, to their very great detriment, and too often to the ruin of them and their families, for preventing therefore such practices for the future, and for the encouragement of learned men to compose and write use books, be it enacted. What they're basically saying is everything we just said. That's the best way to put it. Like you mentioned, there's this incentive. And I also want to shout out the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which pulls a lot of this work together. And it doesn't take too long for them to go to court, right? There's that English this case comes up in English court, Miller versus Taylor. And eventually, for a while, they say, look, as a result of this case in 1769, if you are an author, you get to control the results of your work, right? You get to control how what you made is used. And then that goes into a more philosophical argument. To whom does a work of art belong? Does it belong to the creator? Does it belong to the audience? Does it belong to the guy who buys it? I went to the samurai exhibit in the High recently.
Oh, that looks so cool.
Dude, yeah. It is cool, but they have so much stuff. And there's a thing that freaked me out a little, learning about the proprietors. It's a third generation art collector. So it's like, this guy is the son and grandson of full-time art collectors, and this is but a small piece. Their full museum is in Dallas, I suspect, oil money. But, like, does that stuff belong to them then? Or does it belong to, you know, they bought it. It's interesting. Well,
belong is also sort of a bit of a, you know, black box or a gray right. area kind of yeah. term. Like, it belongs to the reader in terms of the way they interpret it with their imagination, but it doesn't belong to them, and they can just like republish it under their own name and then expect to collect residuals, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, it is a philosophical conversation, but it's also like, it again goes into how do you use your influences as a creator? Like, are you truly, you know, creating something new based on or influenced by something old, or is it so derivative that it is, you know, essentially plagiarizing? And also there's like a whole, you know, industry based on creating derivative work. And sure. not in the legal sense. Derivative works is an IP term in and of itself, or like making a book, you know, out of a TV show or vice
adaptation.
Versa. Or, you know, adaptations, like the catch-all there is derivative work. But, you know, there's the whole concept of mockbusters, you know, where it's like instead of Transformers, it's Transmorphers, and they're basically banking on the fact that some people might not know the difference and rent the bad one, you know, or the cheap one. It's, I believe it's called The Asylum, is a company that makes these kind of, you know, instead of snakes on a plane, snakes sure. on a train. But they probably are, they've got legal representation who are telling them just how far they can push that line.
Like the Revengers instead of the Avengers. These people ran the back aisles of Blockbuster for many years.
Correct.
What we know about intellectual property, or the way it's works out today, even though it does sound kind of ridiculous and you can't get in ridiculous situations with it, a lot of it comes from the United States, which makes sense because one of the biggest U.S. exports is, of course, culture, right? Movies, film, TV, ideas. And the IP system in the U.S. comes from that statute of monopolies I mentioned earlier, 1623, and it still says the same thing. You get exclusive right to your work for a limited time. This comes into something called the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, thanks to a guy named Nathaniel Ward of Ipswich in 1641. And he said, look, we're not going to allow anybody to have monopolies, but if you make a new invention, and it's overall something that we all think is a good idea, then you can have some exclusivity for a short time. The first guy who does this is a guy named Joseph Jenks Sr., which sounds weirdly Appalachian to me. He is given a 14-year patent for the invention of not the first watermill engine, but a faster one. And they're like, hey, good job, Joey. You know, 14 years, bro. You just run with this. Let those ponies run. And then the first American copyright goes to a Massachusetts printer named John Usher just a few decades later, 1672.
Interesting, from Massachusetts. I just I spent a little bit of time over the weekend watching a Criterion Channel collection of Roger Corman films, adaptations of Edgar Allan Poe stories, which is also interesting in terms of intellectual property because those stories, you know, by the 1960s, I believe, were in the public domain. So I don't think you had to pay any licensing fees to do adaptations of them. And Roger Corman was not notorious is the wrong word, but just was very much known for being a very frugal filmmaker. And if you watch some of these, I think they're fabulous. They all star Vincent Price. Some of them reuse shots from previous ones. And the first two are The Fall of the House of Usher, which is with this guy's name, John Usher, the printer that you're talking about. A lot of these stories are based in and around the Boston area, Massachusetts.
Sure.
So
yeah.
Usher is this family that's supposedly cursed, you know. But my point is, the first two movies, The Pit and the Pendulum and The House Fall of the House of Usher, are both set in like the same kind of decrepit mansion,
sure.
With the same kind of misty exterior shots that are clearly like matte paintings and stuff. And both of them sort of borrow shots from one another. But I actually found them completely delightful. Little sidebar, but I couldn't pass up a chance to talk about the name Usher and the fact that there's this whole old English kind of lineage there in Massachusetts around this time.
Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that Massachusetts would be sort of the origin point for a lot of this legal thought, because it's an early colony, because there was so much money and so much innovation in the area at the time. And they weren't alone in this race. They weren't the only people who were trying to figure out how to get their heads around protecting ideas. A lot of colonial governments gave patents and copyrights throughout the 1700s. Typically, though, these were made as special one-off acts of legislation, and they got passed on request. Kind of like you get guacamole on request. I call it the guacamole rule. So if you invented something, you would have to go to your local government and say, hey, lock this down, make this exclusive. Rhode Island, what are we? Anyway, these grants typically all had the same strong commonalities. You can see all sorts of early examples of this, like Peter Garrard in South Carolina in 1691 gets a 2-year patent for a rice husking machine he invents. Rhode Island gives somebody a 10-year patent for the manufacture of soap. And this continues through all kinds of stuff. The Revolutionary War happens, fast forward, and people still want to protect ideas. Massachusetts is one of the first to do this. When the U.S. is newly formed, they make their state constitution, and Massachusetts puts protection of ideas in their constitution, which is pretty cool. Other states didn't do that.
Well, yeah, it makes sense because, like you said, a lot of these early cases were centered right there, and that really was kind of the seat of innovation, you know, in the country at the time. So it makes sense that they would have kind of led the charge. And Massachusetts and the Boston area obviously still continues to be a very important site of academia, you know, sure. And medical innovation.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah, it was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody, like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So even though it was ad hoc, in a lot of other states outside of Massachusetts, they still have the same commonalities. You get exclusivity, but you don't get it forever. And then as people in the newly formed American states started traveling to more and more states, as it became more of a more of an actual country, the need to make the uniform IP legislation became mission critical. So a lot of people, including authors like Noah Webster, started lobbying the federal and state governments to say, hey, copyright legislation, you guys, if I wrote a book in Georgia, then I should still be the guy who wrote the book in New York.
Of course, because, I mean, obviously we're well past the innovation of widespread, you know, typeset printing and all, you know. So, I mean, things are distributed far and wide. And sometimes, you know, sometimes there's smaller printing operations. So what we might think of today as, you know, more bespoke kind of presses, or let's say certain maybe record kind of companies that are smaller that maybe make like high quality bootlegs or something like that. You know, you certainly would have seen that. And if there's no protection, then easily someone could just reprint your work and sell it and make money from it. You know, and if there's no protection, then you would have no recourse as the creator.
Yeah. And that's dangerous because, you know, this is a full-time job for these people. So if they can't make a living off of it, then they can't do it. That's one of the things that I think spurs the conversation along here. You want to have a society where people can create culture. And if you don't have that, if it's not possible for them to do that, then eventually a society that can create culture is going to infiltrate and kind of subsume what you think makes your society its own thing.
That's right. And I mean, you know, it's so easy to romanticize the advent of the United States and all of that and the Constitution, what it stood for. But I mean, there were a lot of things that were very unique to it that it did stand for. And these types of protections that, you know, sort of created the concept of the American dream were kind of, you know, I guess, built into the language of the Constitution, which is what made the United States sort of an interesting kind of like land of opportunity, right?
Yeah. I
mean, even if it didn't always prove out to be that way in practice.
Pursuit of happiness.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. I'm referring to that beautiful line in the Constitution, which basically says, you know, go for it. Do your best. Yeah. Just give it the old college try. So in 1783, Congress passes a pretty important resolution about this that codifies the idea of copyright statutes protecting an author's work for not less than 14 years. Within 2 years of this, by 1785, 12 of the 13 states have passed similar legislation. South Carolina is a little bit of an outlier because they equated copyright and patent protections. They said, it's an idea. It's kind of the same thing. Anyway, you can.
And just to back up, I mean, it wasn't exactly, you know, it's not like one of the part of the Bill of Rights exactly, but it was, you know, the language in the Constitution was suggesting of this sort of protection, left it up to the states. But it seemed like it was already at this point pretty important to most of them.
Yeah, agreed. And here's the problem with this stuff, folks. This is where things often get ridiculous. As anyone can assure you, you can write all sorts of laws. You can put whatever you want on paper. That is not the same thing as those laws being followed, and putting something on paper doesn't make it automatically true. American intellectual property protection was still a really tall milkshake, a crazy bag of badgers for many years after state laws made it really expensive and tough for people to make use of these protections, right? You would already have to kind of be in the system. You'd have to be kind of well-to-do. What I'm saying is, if you were a sharecropper and you wrote an amazing book of poems or meditations on agriculture, then you would have a really tough time getting the protection that you were guaranteed on paper. And the Constitutional Convention, to your point, didn't talk about IP stuff until August. They had other things to do. And as soon as it came through, everyone agreed. They were like, that's fine. That's totally fine. You know, there were 55 people at the Constitutional Convention. Over half had legal training of some sort. Most of them were super deeply involved in their state government. So they all had, or at least over half of them had, some kind of rough understanding of IP law. So this wasn't a hot button issue for them. It was something they could all agree on, which is relatively unusual at any point in American governance.
That's right. And it is a little confusing. And I think that's evidenced by my waffling on this. I mean, there was a clause, an IP clause in the Constitution that was written in after a lot of this kind of state by state embracing of IP law. But even though that it was written into the Constitution, it was sort of imperfectly written, I guess. Mm-hmm. So this whole state-based system of intellectual property protection kind of was a little bit, you know, rough, right?
Yeah, I mean, okay. And I say this with great affection for the Constitution. It was a difficult document to write. They knew it was not going to be perfect. And a lot of times, if you read it, there's this vibe of, you know, make this happen somehow. So
do your best.
Yeah,
we trust you.
Sure. Pursue that happiness, bro. So like the U.S. Constitution does have that IP stuff in there. It's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8. And all they say is, or the gist of it is, quote, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. So just somehow make that happen. That's all the cost. It doesn't say how to do that. It's just like, all right, also that. And, you know, these guys already had a long day at the convention. They've probably been arguing back and forth. Someone says, all right, what about this part? We all know this one. And everybody goes, when's lunch? You know what I mean? Just knock it out.
So once again, hopping across the pond back to Europe, we had countries such as Holland and Switzerland and Belgium and Italy that were modeling their IP laws around what England had accomplished. It's interesting considering that I believe England initially modeled their intellectual property laws off of, what was that, Ben? We talked about that at the very beginning. Was it off of
Florence?
Off of Florence, off of Italy. Exactly. So it's the circle of life there once again. So you're starting to see, you know, we have weirdly also seen, Ben, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, it sort of varies, you know, country by country. But in Europe, there are some laws that are more protective of intellectual property for creatives and for, you know, rights holders than we have here in the United States, right?
Sure. And then there are other countries where that dog doesn't hunt, as they say. You know, right. That leads to some very interesting situations in mainland China, for instance. There are tons of Harry Potter books that J.K. Rowling didn't write. There are thousands upon thousands of unofficial sequels, because it's very much a reading country, to all of your favorite books in the West. There's not an IP law that is enforced uniformly across the globe. And is that a problem? Is that something that does need to be fixed? What does the future bring?
Well, we did start to see, you know, some kind of intellectual property agreements that were more globally sort of focused, like the Berne Convention Treaty, and also something called the Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Agreement, or TRIPS, which took place as recently as 1994. So there is sort of an eye towards, you know, global enforcement of intellectual property taking place, but that all just depends. It's sort of like, it's toothless. It's sort of like a lot of UN resolutions. Like, you're not going to go to war over it. It's it's just sort of more like a play nice. Here's what we've sort of agreed are the rules. But if you're not a participating country, then like you said, with China or whatever, then it's not really, you know, relevant.
Yeah, a lot of it is sort of Western or European rules. And it's kind of, it's weirdly similar to the climate change debate. You know, a lot of developing nations say, well, you wrecked the planet. Why are you pulling the ladder up after you and telling us that we can't do the same thing to succeed?
Well, and also, like, you polluted more, so shouldn't you have to, you know, do more in terms of like carbon credits and things like that, right?
Yeah. And, you know, folks, we don't have to personally agree with that perspective, but we do need to acknowledge it exists. And with that, we are calling it a day. This is the end of part one of our history of intellectual property episode. Now, we gave you a lot of background. We gave you a lot of context. Tune in for part two, because this is when we get to some even more ridiculous stuff, including some examples of what happens when IP beefs get cartoonish. So thanks, as always, to our pal, our super producer, Mr. Max Williams. Thanks to our research associate, Dr. Z.
Indeed. Huge thanks to Christopher Hasiotis here in spirit, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Jonathan Strickland, our very own personal patent troll, or just, you know, a troll. He's sort of more of a bridge troll type figure than a patent one, which we should talk about the concept of patent trolls a little bit. We've certainly mentioned it in the past. But look for a little bit more of that kind of talk in episode two.
I'm taking out a patent on the letter E.
We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy it. Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.